Hello, 911.
Hi. Police department, I'm on exit 278, right before exit 278. Y'all just threw a thing out and blew out my tires with my kids in the car. And every freaking 20 of y'all just left.
A Ford Escape filled with three adults and two children had its tires blown out last Sunday in a case of mistaken identity. So the Volusia County Sheriff's Office had some explaining to do. That and more coming up on Sun Crime State. I'm Tony Holt, crime reporter for the Daytona Beach News Journal. Welcome to Sun Crime State, a podcast that takes an in-depth look at Florida's biggest crime stories of the past and present. In this episode, we'll take a look at a dramatic vehicle pursuit along Interstate 95 across two counties that resulted in deputies nabbing their suspect, but may also lead to a future civil action. Later, in our Only in Florida segment, we'll profile a gut-wrenching child neglect case in which a four-year-old girl talks to a 911 call taker about her unconscious mother. Also later, in our Looking Back segment, we'll examine a 2007 double slaying near Flagler Beach, in which a jealous and estranged boyfriend killed the mother of his child and her new boyfriend while they were asleep in bed. Among my special guests for that segment will be former Flagler County Sheriff Don Fleming and Daytona Beach News Journal legal reporter Frank Fernandez. I will also discuss a new development in that case, courtesy of a ruling Thursday by the Florida Supreme Court. I will talk about the I-95 pursuit gone bad after the break. MJ Locklear was driving his wife, his sister-in-law, and her two children northbound Sunday night on I-95 when his tire exploded. It wasn't the fault of the driver. It wasn't the fault of the tire company. It wasn't the fault of some other motorist who left debris lying in the middle of the road. But it was the fault of Volusia County Sheriff's deputies who deployed stop sticks, a row of spikes law enforcement regularly uses to thwart high-speed pursuits. Locklear's sister-in-law called 911, fuming.
Okay, so they threw out the stop sticks. You hit the stop sticks and blew out your tire?
No, they threw it out in front of us because they thought it was us, and they left us. And they're running off. People, my brother-in-law got out because y'all blew out my freaking tires with my kids in the car. Mm-hmm. And he gets out, and y'all pull the guns on him, and then just got in your car and got in his car and left.
Locklear called 911 himself a little bit later. He also needed to let off some steam.
911, where's your emergency?
It's not an emergency. We've already talked to y'all 30 minutes ago about our tire being blowed out during a hot pursuit that weren't even involved with us and how y'all left us sitting here on the side of the road. I've already almost been sideswiped two or three times. Me with two kids, 5-year-old and 8-year-old in the car.
Okay, sit tight. I put this call up, and we'll be either ourselves or FHP are going to assist you on this, okay?
I mean, how long? We've already been sitting here for 30 minutes. We had already called you. How much longer do I got to sit here on the side of the interstate in this type of traffic? I've already contacted my lawyer about this.
Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood apologized for the mistake. He apologized directly to Locklear and voiced his apology again to the media a few days later. During an interview with the News Journal, Locklear said deputies left him stranded on the side of the road for 2 hours, which endangered him and his family. He said he nearly got sideswiped 3 times. Chitwood refuted the claim that Locklear and his family were stranded. He also said his deputies responded professionally once they realized their mistake.
So my math, and I really was never good at math as a kid, but that's why I became a cop, my information shows that he was on scene for approximately 32 minutes after the stop stick occurred. Now, keep in mind, this whole job is still unfolding. We're still chasing the car with the suspect in it all the way up into Flagler, And when everything settles down, we then get back to him within 12 minutes. And we sit there with this guy until the wrecker company shows up. And you'll see him pull up in the video. So he, at no point in time other than those original 30 minutes when all chaos is going on out there, was this guy left alone.
To further prove his point, Chitwood showed to the media on Wednesday video of deputies staying with the family and consoling the children. The sheriff promised to discipline the deputies who swarmed toward Locklear's car with their guns drawn because they did not have their body cameras activated. Chitwood said an internal affairs investigation would be conducted. Locklear told the sheriff and the media that he planned to file a lawsuit. Locklear's anger did not carry over to the tow truck company that he had waited an hour for to pick up his car. Chitwood told the media that once the incident was over, Locklear asked the company supervisor for a job application because he was so impressed by the employee's professionalism. All along, law enforcement was looking for Darius Davis, who had warrants out for his arrest, including one for grand theft. Davis fled, and authorities said he tried to ram a Daytona Beach police car. Davis's vehicle was later spotted by an Ormond Beach police officer on State Road 40 before he got on I-95. Davis traveled at speeds of up to 90 miles per hour, but he slowed down after he ran over stop sticks near Ormond Beach. Police believed he was armed and dangerous. Coming up, a story out of Palm Beach County of a 4-year-old daughter stranded inside a van with her unconscious mother.
Mom, okay?
You can doctor her.
Okay, is she there?
Yeah.
She's awake?
No.
No, she's not awake. She's in the car?
In her van.
Okay.
The scared 4-year-old girl you heard on the 911 recording sat in the back of a van the morning of August 28th while her mother was unconscious in the driver's seat.
Are you there by yourself with your mom? How old are you?
4.
Hold on 1 second. And what happened? Your mom was going to go take you to school, and she fell asleep?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Okay. How old is your mommy? Do you know? No. Well, do you know where she works?
She works at... no.
Okay. Hold on 1 second.
My daddy works at the casino.
Is your daddy there with you?
No.
Where's Daddy?
Daddy's at home.
The girl was crying when Boca Raton police found her. She told them she just wanted to go to school. Boca Raton police concluded that the girl's mother, 30-year-old Colleen Nichols, had overdosed on Clonopin, a prescription drug to treat seizures and panic disorders. A near-empty bottle was in plain view inside the van. Paramedics used Narcan, a medication in the form of a nasal spray that blocks the effects of opioids. Nichols was revived, but taken to jail and booked on a child neglect charge. Shortly after 8:40 a.m., a witness called 911 to report there was a small child crying inside of a van with a passed-out woman in the driver's seat. Eventually, the girl got on the phone and public safety dispatcher Jamie Ward spoke to her.
I'm going to stay on the phone with you. Can you keep talking to me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Has this ever happened to your mommy before?
No.
Never, right?
Uh-uh.
Huh. Okay.
Last night she fell asleep and again, over and over and over.
Oh, she did?
I don't know what happened to her.
Yeah.
She fell asleep.
Wow. Do you hear those sirens? They're coming to help your mommy.
Nichols was interviewed in the back of the ambulance by police. She denied using drugs.
Police said she was uncooperative, and she told them she could not recall how she wound up inside the van or the ambulance. When a police officer asked Nichols whether she knew where she was, she said she didn't know. She had blacked out, and she was under a lot of stress. Police said Nicole's medicine bottle had been filled the day before with 30 pills. By the time she was found unconscious in the van, there were only two remaining. Records show that Nichols posted $1,000 bail on Tuesday. The Florida Department of Children and Families was contacted. On Thursday, in a Facebook post, Boca Police Chief Dan Alexander praised Ward for her work, adding that public safety dispatch professionals many times are, quote, the most important folks you'll ever meet. Here is another sample of Ward's performance.
You did a good job talking to that man and asking him to call for help. You should be really proud of yourself. You did a really good job. Are the paramedics there?
I grabbed the weight already.
Huh?
I grabbed the weight already. I grabbed the weight already.
You graduated already?
Mm-hmm. I'm almost five. I'm four and a half.
Wow.
Coming up, a 10-year-old murder case that resulted in the death of a young couple, a vacated death penalty sentence, and a custody battle that ended in ironic fashion. Skylar Meekin's grandparents were awakened in the middle of the night by noises they did not recognize. Still lethargic, they fell back asleep without investigating. Skylar's grandmother, Marianne Meekins, woke up later that morning and walked down the hall to make sure the 17-year-old high school student got out of bed in time for her dentist appointment. Marianne saw two bodies lying still in bed, those of Skylar and her new boyfriend, 22-year-old Daniel Dyer. Then she noticed a shotgun lying on the floor. Then she saw the pools of blood. Marianne called out to her son, Skylar's father, Hap, who lived next door on John Anderson Highway near Flagler Beach. He rushed over, saw the gory scene, and called 911. The shotgun blast to Dyer's face was so damaging, Hap wrongly identified him as William Gregory, Skylar's former boyfriend and father to her one-year-old daughter, who was sleeping in a nearby bedroom when the couple was savagely killed. During the hours between the shooting and Hap's 911 call, Gregory also had called law enforcement. He claimed he had taken drugs, which was a violation of his probation. He was calling to turn himself in.
Flagler County 911, urgent emergency.
Hey, how's it going tonight? I'd like to turn myself in, please.
Okay, where are you right now?
I'm at the First Condominiums by the water tower in Flagler Beach.
Do you know the name of them?
No, it's the first one in the back.
What's your name?
William Gregory.
Gregory wasn't taken into jail. A deputy told him he would have to call his probation officer Monday morning. Detectives and prosecutors later concluded Gregory did this in an effort to create an alibi for himself. He wanted authorities to think he was in jail the moment Meekins and Dyer were killed. If anything, it made him look more guilty. Flagler County Sheriff Sergeant Kim Davis and Commander Steve Brandt were among those who investigated the case.
He did things that are not consistent with how people normally act. I don't know if Kim wants to elaborate, but I've never had somebody call it a probation violation on themselves. I've never had somebody behave the way he did, rationally, and not be involved in something. He was kind of all over the place.
He was trying to come up with some kind of an alibi or, you know, that he was busy during the time when the homicides occurred. The first call was at like 4:17 in the morning. He had called and stated he wanted to turn himself in because he felt guilty for smoking crack, using drugs, And the officer's like, you need to call your probation officer in the morning. That's just not something that, you know, they would do. And then the bodies were discovered. And then he ended up receiving a phone call, which we later found out was from the victim's brother, stating you better run in so many words. And he became nervous, left his residence, and went over to the Gamble Rogers State Park and called law enforcement again.
Flagler County 911, where is your emergency?
At Gamble Rogers Ranger Station, I guess. I've been receiving like threatening phone calls. And it said something like, you better run or something. So I went out through the woods, and then I'm at the ranger station. At, I don't know. I need to report a crime or something.
Gregory did more to try to cover his tracks that morning. Former Flagler County Sheriff Don Fleming remembers the case, not only for its brutality, but also in the ways Gregory tried to throw off the detective's scent. The suspect chose an unusual way to literally wash the residue of his crime off his skin. Gregory jumped into a pool in an effort to bathe away the gunpowder remains from the shotgun.
The Gregory case was a very sad thing when a person walks in and shoots somebody in the face while they were sleeping. Just a terrible, terrible thing. And then he walks outside and jumps in the pool with his clothes on and goes, turns himself in and says that he's been doing drugs all night.
Gregory's behavior puzzled everyone, including Daytona Beach News Journal legal reporter Frank Fernandez, who covered Gregory's trial. In the end, it didn't matter what Gregory did. Detectives were going to link him to the murder.
He had the motive. They had the fingerprints. The suspicious just trying to get himself arrested on the morning that she that the murders occurred, that alone was kind of strange. I mean, who calls the probation officer? Who calls 911 and tries to get arrested?
In spite of the perception of a slam dunk case, the Meekins family and everyone else had to wait a few weeks before charges were filed. On the day after the shootings, Fleming confirmed to the media that detectives had a person of interest in mind, but he would not confirm whether it was Gregory, who the media discovered had just been jailed for his probation violation. Fleming did say that Gregory was among the pool of people being questioned for the double shooting. Behind the scenes, Gregory was the prime suspect. Others were being questioned, but detectives were gleaning as much information as they could to build their case against Gregory. From the beginning, it was apparent to everyone involved in the investigation, including Fleming, that Gregory was the culprit.
You know, to me, that's a preconceived, meditated crime. What he did, he knew he was going to do. He planned it, he conceived it, and he carried it out. And justice is being served as we talk.
Skylar Meekins grew up in a household with little supervision. She oftentimes would miss school while growing up. But when she had her daughter, Kyla, at 16 years old, her life changed. And according to close friend and soccer teammate Patricia Butler, Skylar's biggest support system came from her friends. And she had a lot of them.
She was a tough girl, you know. I wouldn't say she had the best bringing up. So, you know, she had to be tough, and she had to do what she could to get by. And, you know, she was outgoing and really friendly, and she made the best of every situation that she was in.
Gregory would stalk Meekins. She broke off the relationship in June, 2 months before she was killed, and while Gregory was still in jail serving time for assault. He would be released in July. In spite of the split, Gregory would regularly call Skylar. When he couldn't reach her on the phone, he'd call her family and her friends in an effort to contact her. There were times when he would slip into her home through the bedroom window without permission. He was so desperate to meet up with her, he would steal items out of her home just so he could return them and see her again. He would also hide behind the trees on the Meekins property, watching Skylar swimming in the pool with her new boyfriend.
Skylar told one of her friends that Gregory once showed up in her bedroom uninvited and threatened Dyer in front of her. Skylar never filed a restraining order. Her family said Skylar always gave Gregory the benefit of the doubt. She also couldn't bring herself to file an injunction against her baby's father. Former Assistant State Attorney Jackie Royce was one of the trial prosecutors. She remembered Gregory's behavior and the way it conflicted with Skylar's forgiving nature. It was like she wasn't fully aware of the danger she was in while Gregory was in her life.
He was doing these things that were very scary, and if you, you know, once you learned the full range of what he was doing, it was very diabolical. But to her, she was just saying, oh no, he's being nice, you know, oh, he has that, he's returning it. But the reality was that he would sneak into the home, he would take these items just so he would have an excuse to reach back out to her so he could make plans to see her, things like that.
On the night of August 20th, hours before the shootings, Gregory called Skylar's home seven times between 10:05 and 10:27 p.m. Skylar never answered the phone. She didn't want to talk to him. Gregory's phone records also showed he had called a local cab company, but the length of those calls showed there was likely no connection. Detectives concluded that Gregory walked or skateboarded the hour and a half from his house to Skylar's house. Her grandparents heard the shots around 1:08 a.m. on August 21st, only they didn't realize it was gunshots. The late Charles Meekins, Skylar's grandfather, described the noises as sounding like a yardstick banging against the terrazzo floor. After the sun came up, Marianne noticed two things that were different. The closet door was open, as well as the door to Skylar's room. Both always remained shut during the night. Coming up, you'll hear more from Butler and Fleming and Royce, and I'll discuss the various courtroom developments in both the criminal case and the custody case of Kyla Meekins. When the news of Skylar's death reached Flagler Palm Coast High School, teachers and administrators frantically put a plan in motion to break the news to Skylar's soccer teammates. One school official called Butler while she was still asleep. When she was told to come to school early, she assumed something was wrong, but she thought maybe her team was being disciplined.
So the dean of the school, actually Bob Sawyer, called me and woke me up. I didn't have first period. I was a senior, so I got to sleep in, and I was going to the second period. And he called me, and I think one of the other seniors that wasn't in school yet, and, you know, told her she was come to school. And my first thought was, oh my God, what did we do to the volleyball players? You know, because we were always going back and forth with other, you know, girl athletes and this and that. So I truly thought we were in trouble. And then we got to school, and just everyone, all of the deans, everyone had water in their eyes. Immediately I knew just something was wrong. We got into the room, and all of the other soccer girls were all sitting in a circle. And the dean, you know, that called me, Bob Sawyer, he came in, and I can't remember. It was kind of a blur, but I don't remember if he told us or Coach Howell, our soccer coach, told us. But, you know, they laid it out on us and told us everything that happened. Actually, Coach Howell told us, I remember now, and just told us straight up, you know, this is what happened, and she was murdered. And at that time, they didn't know. Well, actually, they didn't even say she was murdered. They just told us that she was dead. They didn't tell us what happened at that time. They waited a little while to tell us. And the whole soccer team stayed in the classroom the entire day. And we just, you know, talked about Skylar and memories we had with her and laughed and cried. And just, you know, for the entire day, we stayed there.
During Skylar's funeral a week later, emotions boiled over. There was sadness over Skylar's death, surrealism of seeing Kyla, who was the spitting image of her mother, at the funeral. And there was also the awkwardness of seeing Meekin's family mixing with the Gregory family. Butler's memories of that day remain vivid.
The funeral was really tough, and seeing Kyla was really tough. She is Skylar's twin. I mean, she looks just like her. It's like a ghost. I have goosebumps just thinking about her. The funeral was really sad, extremely sad. And like I said about her upbringing, there was drama at her funeral. Her mother and stepfather were fighting with her father, and Billy's mother tried to steal Kyla at the funeral. It was chaos, and it was like you're in a TV show, the stuff that happened. It was like just complete chaos.
Fleming also recalled the atmosphere of that day. Grief was palpable.
I remember going to the wake, and I've been to hundreds of wakes before that for other people, with other children and younger children. And, you know, all of these crimes, they leave a lasting imprint, I think, in a law enforcement's mind for the rest of his life. I think he stores it in the back of his brain until somebody like you comes along and asks me to review the case again and look at it, you know. And then you start thinking about how bad it was and how big of an impact it had on the family, you know, and what impact it has on them today, you know. Victims never go away. Victims are always there. Victims remain there to the last day that they take a breath.
During the next 3 weeks, while detectives waited for fingerprint analysis to be tested, interviews with family and acquaintances of Skylar's painted Gregory in an unflattering light. The incriminating behavior kept mounting.
He had specifically said that if he ever caught her with someone else, he would blow her f-ing head off. And as we know, ultimately that was what happened to Skylar. That's how she died. There were multiple witnesses that he had said that to. He also said that he would kill anyone he ever found her with, according to these witnesses. So that was strong evidence.
At one point, Gregory was transferred from the county jail in Bunnell to the one in neighboring St. Johns County for safety reasons, after rumors swirled in the community about plans to hurt him. Butler herself never felt safe, even though she barely knew Gregory, and even though he was behind bars in another county.
The feeling that I got was I was also in danger. Like, I thought, you know, for him to just murder her and Daniel, it was just, you know, such a scary thing for a 17-year-old girl, you know? And I remember I was afraid for months for my own life, and I don't even know if he knew me, you know, but I was just so terrified that he was going to come and, you know, get someone else that she was close to.
In late September 2007, a grand jury indicted Gregory on 2 counts of first-degree murder. The state attorney sought a death sentence. He sat in jail for more than 3 years until his jury trial, which was scheduled for October 2010. He didn't sit quietly. During a pretrial motion hearing, it was discovered that Gregory was making plans to rub out the woman tasked with putting him on death row.
The details were not, I don't think, well thought out. But a witness came forward and said that Billy Gregory's plan was, once he beat the charges, once he was found not guilty, he was going to get out of jail and come hunt me down and take care of me.
Take care of her, as in kill her. Gregory's defense attorney motioned to prevent that evidence from being presented at trial. Royce, perhaps in a surprise move, didn't fight the motion. She was as unintimidated by Gregory as she was confident in her case.
But no, I did not believe that it was anything that should be used in trial. I was comfortable with the evidence that we had. And more importantly, I didn't want him to think that it was something that was going to intimidate me, or, you know, that
I felt for a second that he was going to beat those charges. So it wasn't you.
When the trial date came around, it was time for the arduous task of selecting a jury in Flagler County. It was especially challenging for attorneys to select 12 impartial jurors. In the end, it became impossible. It was supposed to have been the last major trial in the long, impressive legal career of the late Circuit Court Judge Kim Hammond. Here's Frank Fernandez explaining what happened in the 11th hour before opening arguments.
That was very interesting. It was basically a juror said he owned a fingerprint company that analyzed fingerprints. A potential juror, I should say, owned this company that analyzed fingerprints for the FDLE. And he said that his company had analyzed fingerprints in this case, and that the defense would not be happy with him, but prosecutors would be. And he told this, apparently he said this in front of other potential jurors. That, combined with the fact that they had basically run out of alternate jurors and they only had the bare minimum of 12 jurors for the trial, meant that when Judge Hammond disqualified this juror, the one that reported the comments from the prospective juror who owned the company that did fingerprints, the jury was just short. They were left with 11 people. So he had to declare a mistrial. Judge Hammond said it was perhaps the only mistrial he had ever declared in his long career.
Subsequently, the trial was reassigned to another judge and was moved south to Volusia County. Gregory's trial and sentencing hearing finally took place in February and March of 2011. Gregory never testified. Jurors heard all the evidence. The prints on the weapon. The way he tried to control and manipulate Skyler. The way he threatened Dyer and sarcastically thanked him for ruining his life. Prosecutors described how Gregory burglarized the Meekins' home, opened the closet door, grabbed a box of ammo from the shelf, and loaded two shells into the shotgun before walking down the hall into Skyler's bedroom to kill her and her boyfriend as they spooned and slept. They heard the medical examiner describe how Gregory pressed the muzzle of the shotgun against Dyer's face and pulled the trigger before wasting no time to do the same to the girl he was infatuated with. Jurors took 2 hours and 40 minutes to find Gregory guilty. After more witness impact testimony, they deliberated for 90 minutes before recommending death by a 7-5 vote. The Florida Supreme Court ruled in October 2016 that a death sentence cannot be imposed without a unanimous vote from jurors. On Friday, the Florida Supreme Court officially vacated Gregory's death sentences. The state attorney's office is still reviewing its next move: hold a new sentencing hearing seeking death, or agree to a life sentence, which would not require a new evidentiary hearing. Fernandez said a death sentence for Gregory wasn't the unanimous wish, even among Skyler's family members.
Some of the family members, they were split. Some of them wanted to see the person put to death and would like another death penalty phase. Others were just saying, we can't go through this again. This has been very difficult for us. We don't want to relive all this again. Just put the person away for life and don't let him out.
It remains to be seen what will happen next. Royce said an entire trial would essentially have to be held again, just to educate jurors on the evidence that was used to convict Gregory. Only then could they make a well-calculated decision on life or death. Fleming has his own opinion.
I myself have never been a strong proponent of a death sentence or a death penalty. I would rather have that person stay in a 6x6 jail cell for the rest of his life with no chance of parole rather than death penalty. I think my religion just doesn't allow me to do that. But I take a stronger stand on that. I just believe that a person who commits a crime like that and gets found guilty by a court of his peers will never, ever get the opportunity to be rehabilitated and come back out into our society. Just lock them away, throw the key away, and leave them alone. Bye.
There were actually two legal sagas following Skyler's murder. One was the criminal case against Gregory, and the second was the custody battle for his and Skyler's daughter, Kyla. When a judge found out in early 2008 that Kyla had visited her father while in jail, a judge ruled that she could not come within 500 feet of him. From that moment on, Hap Meekins had a stranglehold on the custody privileges for Kyla. Gregory's mother, meanwhile, maintained visitation rights. The girl spent most of her life with her maternal family. But all that came to a halt in early 2014 when the Florida Department of Children and Families removed Kyla from Hap Meekins' home and placed her in the care of her paternal grandmother. She has full custody of her today. Details of that case have never been made public. Hap Meekins was never charged criminally, but a DCF spokesman told me during an interview in 2014 that his agency only removes a child from a home in that situation where there is a clear danger to the child as a result of abuse or neglect. The hearings on the matter were closed. Hap Meekins at the time told me he never got to argue his side in court. He also never heard the allegations made by DCF. In that instance, when one parent is dead and another is on death row, it becomes an adoption issue, and the party that wields all the influence is DCF. Butler, a new mother herself, acknowledged the uncomfortable irony of having Skyler's daughter being raised by the family of her mother's killer. But she suspects the latest outcome is probably for the best.
To be honest, I'm kind of happy that she's not with the Meekins, because for DCF to take a child away, they don't just take them away for no reason. I know from being a child that I wasn't allowed to go to their house. I went there one time and I never went back. Skyler spent every night and time we hung out at my house, and that was, you know, that's a good reason for me to not want a little girl to be raised in the household again. And it breaks my heart. I want to take her. You know, I would take her. But I don't know the Gregorys, but I, you know that they cared enough to fight for her. You know, and I know both families did, but I only know one family. So I just hope and pray. And I know DCF checks in, and I know that she's looked after, and you know, yeah.
Kyla is now 11 years old. The Gregory family, as of 2014, was living in Palm Coast. William Gregory still remains behind bars at Union Correctional Institution in Rayford, which is one of Florida's three death row facilities. Thank you for tuning in. Next week, we will take a look at a 1985 capital murder case in Hernando County that resulted in a new trial. The state, for the third time, is seeking the death penalty against the defendant. Among my special guests will be former Tampa Bay Times columnist Dan DeWitt. See you then.
You can find Tony on Twitter at TonyCrimeWriter or email him at tony.holt@news-jrnl.com. Be sure to rate us on iTunes. Sun Crime State is recorded by Tony Holt and produced by Chris Bridges for the Daytona Beach News Journal.